Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Daniel Foster, news editor at National Review Online, and for Jim Garrity, who's out for a couple of weeks. And Dan, it's good to have you with us. Good news, bad news, crazy news for conservatives. I guess the first one should be couched as potentially good news for conservatives.
Yeah.
Yesterday, John Boehner, the current and I would assume future Speaker of the House, since Republicans held the House in Tuesday's elections, came out and basically offered something of an olive branch to President Obama, saying, "You won. Now's your moment to lead. The big issue is this fiscal cliff." And while he made overtures to the debt ceiling and to entitlement reform, the big thing was this fiscal cliff coming up, and specifically tax reform. He said that he's open to revenues by going through tax reform, but he's not about to cave on the critical Republican point of not raising marginal tax rates at this moment. So on the good news, Dan, you've got Boehner sticking strong on the central point of the recent smaller tax debate. He's also pushing for long-term tax reform, which I think, if done right, would provide certainty and be helpful to the economy potentially. But at the same time, every time this clash has happened over the past 2 years, it seems like John Boehner's been the one giving ground, giving ground, giving ground. And I hope that there's reason to hope for a different outcome here, but I'm a little bit skeptical.
The big debate revolves around whether Boehner meant something like getting new revenue through what they call dynamic scoring, which means that if you lower tax burdens on some people, you encourage growth. Everybody remembers the 80s. It's indeed true, and everybody, including the CBO, admits that there are some what they call growth effects of cutting taxes in various ways. You end up getting more revenue because you encourage economic activity because people have more money in their pockets. Now, if that's what Boehner means by new revenue, then people on the right are going to be happy about it. Conservatives should be happy about it, but certainly liberals are not happy about it, and they already think that's what Boehner means. So hopefully that's what he does mean. Now, on the other hand, we can't forget that our candidate, Mitt Romney, ran on a tax reform plan that would involve cutting marginal rates, but eliminating certain tax preferences and loopholes and deductions and things like that in a way that could add revenue in ways beyond what they call growth effects, or, you know, the effects of dynamic scoring. So, you know, we should be open to that stuff too. You know, we don't want taxpayers to get gouged at any level or tax burdens to be raised. But there's something to be said for, I think, the conservatism of a tax policy that doesn't rely on 300 or 400 different little breaks given to you by the government. As you put it, the key word is certainty. I'd rather pay a tax bill where I know what my marginal rate is, and I don't have to worry about checking 300 or 400 boxes or conforming my behavior to what the government thinks entitles me to a refundable tax credit. I'd rather the tax system be straightforward. So if we can do tax reform that simplifies things and maybe gets some revenue based on growth and the elimination of certain tax breaks that nobody likes or that we all agree we can't afford, well, I'm fine with that. But you're right, I think, to be concerned that Boehner could read this as another opportunity to give too much ground. But that's something we'll see over the next couple of months.
Yeah, and he's got a debt ceiling fight that he's going to have to negotiate his way through as well. And a lot of folks out there saying he needs to be far more firm than he was last time. Of course, you mentioned certainty, and you mentioned the fact that ultimately, when all is said and done with the revision of the tax code, if in fact it happens, that ultimately people's tax burden is certainly no more and hopefully a little bit less than it is right now, and just in a way that encourages economic growth that will pump a lot of revenue into the federal coffers as well. Obviously, that is designed to grow the economy by growing jobs, but right now, there's not exactly a lot of optimism out there. Boeing is the first in what I would guess is kind of the post-election parade to announce a major restructuring of its defense division on Wednesday that will cut, this is according to CNBC, 30% of management jobs from 2010 levels, close facilities in California, and consolidate several business units to cut costs. Sounds like some of this was just based on existing business, but it's in the defense division, so there's a lot of uncertainty. There's that word again when it comes to sequestration. And I don't think it's a coincidence that they're closing facilities in California, which just voted to jack up taxes once again on themselves, mind you. And so once again, while there's a lot of people who want this to be the hopey-changey moment in the wake of an election, the harsh realities on the ground say something very different.
Yeah, and Boeing is saying that this has nothing to do with the looming defense cuts, and nobody, I don't think, really believes that. It's actually the same argument that liberals made about the auto bailouts and why it was necessary to bail out all of the big three, even Ford that, you know, at the time didn't really want money. The argument was that the businesses, you know, as an industrial sector, the resources are so clustered and they're so interdependent on each other that, you know, if Ford goes out of business, then the spare parts manufacturers that make parts for Ford and GM and Chrysler go out of business and you have this whole domino effect. That was the argument they made. The difference with the defense industry is that it's actually a vital function of the United States government to defend the nation. And there is something like that going on. Boeing's, you know, their defense division's a massive, massive part of their business. The government is their biggest client. And it's one of those things where policy uncertainty in Washington, even a little bit over whether the sequester is going to happen or not, whether these really draconian defense cuts are going to kick in that nobody wants, is leading to massive restructuring of one of the biggest, you know, aeronautical companies in the world. And I don't think anyone can really deny the connection. And the California thing, you know, it's probably true too. You get out of where you have the worst tax environment. You said they just voted to increase taxes mainly on the rich. So I don't know about the themselves business. In January, California will become the first state to institute a unilateral cap and trade system. So we'll see how that works out.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I don't live in California. I'll say that much. Moving on to martini number three now, Dan. And of course, there's been a lot of commentary and debate and outrage in the wake of the Benghazi attacks, which happened almost 2 months ago now. Our ambassadors killed three other Americans, others around the consulate when that terrorist attack happened. But the president said that those who are responsible for this would be brought to justice. And in his world, perhaps that happened yesterday, because the producer of the anti-Mohammed film Innocence of Muslims has been sentenced to a year in federal prison on 8 probation violations. You might remember the federal raid in the middle of the night, which I'm sure would have happened on these probation violations if, in fact, he had never made the film, or if the attack on the consulate had never happened. According to the prosecutor in this case, he denies that the video had anything to do with the probation matter, but went on to say that this man, Youssef, had betrayed the actors who appeared in the film by not telling them he was a recently released convicted felon. Also, before uploading the film, which portrays the Prophet Muhammad as a womanizer and a child abuser, Youssef had dubbed inflammatory dialogue in place of words actually spoken by the actors. And then the prosecutor says he made that choice for other people. Such behavior illustrates his long-standing pattern of deception. So, Dan, this scourge is finally off the streets.
Yeah, I mean, this guy, I don't even know what to say about it. This poor guy, it's not an exaggeration to call him a political prisoner at this point. Local prosecutors aren't always the brightest bulbs in the joint, but for this guy to say, oh, it had nothing to do with the video, and then, you know, give this self-righteous speech, you know, about how it's a part of a pattern of deception, really just disturbing. And frankly, I think it's a disgrace. And it's an example of, you know, we see the administration using selective prosecution a lot of other places, including in immigration. That's essentially the core of the DREAM Act by fiat that President Obama instituted last, you know, this year. And here's another example of prosecutorial discretion used to silence a guy who created a big mess for the administration. Very sad.
Well, at least it was the excuse used by the administration for the mess that they found themselves in. Dan, as always, great to have you with us, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us. Dan and I will be back tomorrow for the Friday edition of the 3 Martini Lunch. Please join us then.